welcome, all of you. A forum is intended to have everyone feel like you can participate. We'd enjoy doing that. But we kind of kick it off up here among us. And when we came up with this idea of the images of creation, I tried to think of how to introduce it. And I remembered only a portion of a poem written by James Weldon Johnson called The Creation. And since there isn't very much of it, I can recite as much as I remember. It begins, "And God stepped out on space, and he looked around and said, 'I'm lonely. I'll make me a world.' And as far as the eye of God could see, darkness covered everything, blacker than 100 midnights down in a cypress swamp. Then God smiled, and the light broke, and the darkness rolled up on one side, and the light stood shining on the other. And God said, 'That's good.'" So creation is what we have as our gift, and we're going to talk about it tonight in several ways. And we're going to start with just a few slides that James has prepared for us.
The Hebrews have a saying, L'chaim. Does anybody know what that means? To the light. And here we are talking about images, and as some of you may know, I've been teaching a digital photography class the last 4 days, and tomorrow and then also next week for those of you that are here. I'm only going to show one slide because this is so well done that you really don't need any more. It's one of my students. I gave her, it was at the theme for the day was see the picture. So in other words, the idea was that a good photographer, you don't have to be professional to do that. You could do it, probably have. You need to kind of see the image before you take it and act accordingly. So, turn this off. This is not staged, and that's not a telephoto. She got a mug of hot chocolate, and there was a, if you remember the sermon on heaven a couple nights ago, for those that were here, the person said, "And the chipmunks believe it is heaven." And there's why. So I taught them how to use the macro setting, which allows you to get real close without a telephoto. She's actually that close to this chipmunk. But the chipmunk, look at the tongue dripping hot chocolate, is so intent on that having its fill of hot chocolate that nothing else really matters. So there is your introduction. And that's what you can learn if you're in the class. Okay.
Thanks. Yes, why don't you offer
it? Sure. Okay. Anybody else need the screen? Otherwise, I'll turn that off.
For me, because I'm a biologist and a forester, and I spend a lot of time outdoors. I spend a lot of time looking at the landscape, and you go on a hike and you look across the valley, and it's just so beautiful. And for me, I find it more, there's something about being outside and seeing the wildlife that I always try to explain it to people or people that maybe don't go out as much, and how, for me, it's spiritual. And I was reading this book, this person, Bill Mason, he's a Christian, he's a Canadian, and he made wildlife films. But he always had he was always told that you couldn't put God and spirituality in the films, because that it wouldn't work, and he struggled when he did his wildlife films, on always trying to get something into his films that talked about the creation and the birds and the animals and wildlife. But he has a really good quote, and it's actually from Job, the book of Job, chapter 12, 7 through 10, and I'll just read it to you. It says, "But ask the animals, and they will teach you, the birds of the air, and they will tell you. Ask the plants of the earth, and they will teach you, and the fish of the sea will declare to you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is the life of every living creature and the breath of mankind." And you know, reading that just kind of explains to me how the animals and the wildlife and the birds just by looking at them and being outdoors, to me anyways, they're declared, you know, like this one, the statement, "And the fish of the sea will declare to you who created this." So that's all I wanted to add. It's for me, being outside is like a kid going to a toy store. I get excited about it, and it's kind of a deep excitement, a spiritual excitement for me to be outside, and this verse kind of explains that the, you know, the animals, the birds are declaring, "Hey, look at me. You know, this is what was created by someone." And so that's what I had to add to that.
I will follow that. And I don't like the fact that I'm sitting in front of half the people in the room. So. I was originally going to start with an image from beginning of Genesis, but Judy, you did it so lovely from James Weldon Johnson, I'm not feeling the need to repeat that. And in light of what Gus was saying, I think it's all so easy for us here at Holden to acknowledge the truth of the poem and of what you're saying and of the image that you were in, James. So not to pour rain on that parade, but just to place it in some context. Most of you know the last couple of weeks I've been doing this contrast in the Hebrew Bible between what I call the religion of creation, which affirms all of what you've just been hearing, and then the religion of empire, which is the human claim to take control of all of this in the name of God. And so the image I'd like to offer just briefly, this is from 1 Kings, and this is near the end of the description of Solomon's retinue and largesse and such. And it says here, "All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. None were of silver. It was not considered as anything in the days of Solomon. For the king had a fleet of ships of Tarshish at sea with a fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the fleet of ships of Tarshish used to come bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks." So for Solomon, apes and peacocks are about the same as gold and silver and wood, and there's objects of status. I guess I'd just like to put into the picture here, while we enjoy these images of creation as a toy store, and of this harmony between the wildlife and our life, that there's also this legacy that creation is there for our entertainment, for our control, for our use in any means we see fit. And I don't believe that's the way of God, and that's why I think this text is not the word of God, but it's in the Bible.
I have two offerings around the story in Exodus of the plagues. And folks remember in Exodus, there's sort of this cosmic battle that's carried out in which the land of Egypt is both kind of battlefield and weapon. And there's ways that it's kind of an undoing of the creation story. There's ways in which it's sort of an assault on the religion of the Egyptian Empire, and a pretty blatant taking apart of the kind of the food infrastructure of Egypt as well. And there's two ways to talk about what those succession of events are called. There's the word that we mostly use, the plagues, and about as often they're referred to as signs and wonders. Mm-hmm. And so both of the offerings that I have are how do grapple in different ways with the question of how do we who live in a time of environmental crisis read the signs and see the signs in creation. So the first is a poem by Martha Shelley, and then the second is a little story about my neighborhood. Maybe old Egypt was lucky after all. So what if the Nile stank of blood for a week? Year after year, our rivers run excrement, effluent, profit, and poison. The Egyptians scratched lice and slapped at gnats, and when the locusts devoured the crops, they netted the critters and fried them for dinner. We're fool enough to poison the bugs, the birds that eat them, and our wheat as well. Their cattle died and frogs overran the land. Our cattle overgraze and we burn down the forests to feed them. We've developed chemicals that eat the sky and kill all the pretty little amphibians. Our frogs are rarer than princes. They had boils, we have AIDS. They had hailstorms, but everyone gets some bad weather. We could bear the blows of heaven and earth, even endure a child's death, bear all evils but two that cause most misery, human greed and human cruelty. And the second story, the second offering, is a little story from some events that happened in my neighborhood in the downtown east side of British Columbia. It's mostly referred to as the poorest postal code in Canada. It's more accurately the poorest off-reserve postal code. And when not on a First Nations reserve. So when the Olympic Games came to the city of Vancouver, when our city won the bid to host the Olympic Games, there was a whole lot of outcry from different places, mostly over the fact that vast amounts of money were going to be spent on this spectacle, and money that wasn't then going to housing, that wasn't going to childcare, that wasn't going to health. And in our neighborhood that a whole lot of people see as plagued, and see as plagued as a sign of kind of the sinfulness of the people that live there. It's a neighborhood with very high rates of HIV, mostly through injection drug use. It's a neighborhood with hugely high numbers of missing and murdered Aboriginal women, mostly women involved in sex commerce and survival sex. People in our neighborhood started organizing, and I happened even to be wearing the shirt that our organizing event is about, and that's a little hard to read, but what we pulled together was a popular theater event called the Poverty Olympics. And it was a growing thing that happened over a succession of years, where folks in the neighborhood got together to have our own celebration of resistance and competed in games that lampooned the spectacle. So we had things like bootstraps high jump, where competitors had to pull themselves up over the high jump bar by their own bootstraps. And we had the bedbug long jump, where people in Velcro had to leap across a bed of Velcro, or a bed of stuffed bedbugs. And a fantastically popular event where children dressed as community and solidarity and neighbors wrestled a real estate developer to the ground. And in that, just like the regular Olympics, we had mascots. And we had fabulous mascots that were made from all manner of thrift store gloomings. And our mascots were, they were Itchy the Bedbug, Creepy the Cockroach, and I can't remember, Somebody the Rat. And, you know, our neighborhood is plagued by all of these things, and for our community, those became a sign of our resistance rather than a sign of, you know, God's or empire's disfavor.
You are invited to participate in any way. This sparks some ideas from you, or the panel.
I had an interesting new thought on creation one day, listening to a podcast of the NPR show Radiolab. And what the theoretical scientist was talking about was that somewhere there's a room just like we're sitting in, with people who look just like us duplicated in the universe. Mm-hmm. And the person talking to him said, well, how can that be? I mean, we're all so unique. And so he, and I'm no mathematician, but he went on to explain that mathematically, the odds are that somewhere everything would be the same. I mean, the molecules would arrange themselves exactly the way they are here. And that seems impossible, you know, to me as a human, and yet it also is an explanation of creation and just how immense the whole thing is.
More than 6 degrees of separation.
More like 6 dimensions of separation.
But that no matter how vast it is, it'll be replicated.
Well, it's hard to look up at the sky at night and all those twinkling lights and realize there's billions more that are out of our sight, and think that we're the only creatures that may not look like us in the whole universe. It's hard to believe.
So Wes, on the, you said that near the end there about man, or, you know, that the animals and the earth and was put here, or I wonder if you could elaborate on the, you know, for our use and to do as what we please with. Is that is that something, can you elaborate a little bit? Is that?
Well, that's what I'm claiming, that's what Solomon is seeing it as,
right.
And that's what I'm claiming is part of this other religion, which is the religion in the Bible that's the opposite of what Jesus proclaimed in a body. The opposite of what's contained in a good chunk of the Hebrew Bible, which is, as we see in Genesis 1, that all of creation is good before people even get there, independent of people. I mean, what a social scientist might call deep ecology. It's not good because it's good for us, it's good in itself, before there's human beings. But simultaneously in the Bible is the view, which is often the view that we practice, which is that it's there for our use, for our entertainment, for our extraction. And of course, we live in the Pacific Northwest that was populated by Europeans because there were beavers and otters and salmon to skin and throw, well, not the salmon to skin, but the others to skin and save their fur and throw away the animals until there were almost no more. And people that were doing that didn't think they were evil. The prevailing religion of empire view upon which this country was founded is that that's all there for us to use as we see fit. Forests are there to cut down as we see fit to turn into, I mean, maybe people all know this, but the single biggest use of cutting forests down in the history of this country is railroad ties. So whole states full of forests were cut down to make railroad ties to create the Continental Railroad. Okay. And it's partly because those kinds of texts are in the Bible that quote-unquote Christians can justify doing all that stuff. An image, since you asked, and we're talking about images here, that this spoke so powerfully to me when I first moved to Seattle in 1983, and some of you, I'm sure, have been in the area longer than that, you could go down to Elliott Bay, on the waterfront, and in the evening, in the right season, the salmon would jump. You'd see them jump, and they'd shine in the sun. It was this wonderful thing. You'd see them jump out of the water. You don't see that anymore in the last 30 years. At the turn of the 20th century, you look at the archival pictures of Seattle waterfront, the daily catch of salmon were piled up this high, lined up all along the waterfront. And you know what they did with them? People know what they did with salmon in the early 20th century in Seattle catch? Now it's a luxury item, right? Wow, we have salmon! Anybody, you know what they did with
it? Was it a fertilizer?
Almost. Because they were so unwanted, they canned them and sent them across the rail by the railroad, across the ocean, to be English working class food. Something like what tuna has been. Nobody thinks, oh, we're having tuna for dinner. Right? Wow. Now maybe it was a bluefin, right? But a can of tuna is like not something you think of, wow, we're having tuna. Well, that's what salmon was, 100 years ago. Shipped 6,000 miles because nobody here wanted it. But that also says how much of it there was. So when we have that kind of attitude, that's what we do. We just take it and take it and take it and take it and do whatever we want with it, and then it's gone.
Matt, I'm reminded of the word shalom, biblical understanding. Is that something that rings a bell with you?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Well, other people would probably speak to this with more authority than I would about what shalom would mean, but I think of shalom having dimensions that include right relationship with other people and with the creation. The proclamation of justice interconnected with peace and reconciliation. So that's right relationship between people and between people and creation. I think I'm thinking about the word solidarity that came out of Laurel's sharing, and I'm thinking about just other images that we've had, and Wes, what you're saying, and I think it's a challenge to learn how are we to be spiritually shaped to work and live for shalom, to be in solidarity with the creation for real? Because I think it can be easy to have my consciousness raised and say, okay, well, I recycle now. But I'm still largely in the objectifying relationship with the creation. and disconnected from it. And so I think where I stand right now is just wondering, well, what is solidarity or a deeper spiritual relationship or a changed identity? What is the different identity that we're reaching for? That paves the way for shalom. That's not just like, okay, well, I put my cans and my glass out for the trash this week, so I'm in solidarity with the religion of creation. Like, it's something different. And, you know, like, just doing the energy audit with your church congregation, it doesn't do it. I think that we're fumbling our way towards it. But it's like a renewal from the bottom up of what religion is, I think.
At the risk of having spoken already more than once, can I suggest one thing about what you said? Because it was what I was going to say at the beginning. I think it runs, it's so deep in all of us. I'm not in any way pointing the finger at you, Matt. You said shalom is relationships between people, between people and people and creation, as if those were two different things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the problem.
Indeed, a lot of what we're talking about here is spiritually based and based on writings from biblical text, but creation goes even before that. And first and foremost, we are organisms in this creation, and we came up from microorganisms whose goal is to consume their environment until they survive. And that's what we have done, and that's what we continue to do. As we go forward, it's imperative that we realize that all of that is us. And in order to be that organism and survive even beyond this world, we need to realize that we are part of that ecosystem and we rely on it.
Just to start a conversation, my former life was a veterinarian, and I guess all my background and whatnot would somehow relate to Darwin's evolution of species, or evolution, having been to the Galapagos and whatnot. I've seen a lot of this, and my training has been this way, and I have to admit that at times I'm very puzzled by creation. I believe in God, I'm a Christian, but I have to admit my puzzlement, and maybe Scott or somebody duty can enlighten more. I'm just being very honest, and I guess I just want to start a conversation on this.
Say more about your puzzlement. What's the area of puzzlement? What do you mean exactly?
Well, I guess the puzzlement is whether, where everything started. Did God create man? Did we evolve from, like you say, microorganisms, or what? And I say it's a puzzlement to me anyway. And I think to many, many people, if they're honest with themselves. And I know my wife will probably kill me for saying that.
Well, you were educated in biology.
Yeah, I have to admit that way, because
and animals,
that
and,
way.
And so was I.
Yeah.
And you know, I occasionally have the same question. For me, it's like, I can look at a valley and imagine that a glacier came through and carved the rocks out and made this neat valley. But I can also look at a bird and go, you know, that bird is strange enough that, you know, with the, you know, the bird or the fish, like the fish with the light out front,
mm-hmm.
to attract other fish. I'm going,
sure.
Somebody made that fish, because that's not going to be, that fish didn't evolve. So somebody creative, you know, made that little fish with the little light bulb. And so I look at the animals and I go, somebody made that. But, you know, I can also see,
a
valley.
Did it evolve for a purpose?
Yeah, but I can also see, I've had that same question too.
I have the same
but I
thoughts about it too, but I tend to think that these creatures had to be created by a greater being, God. But there's a part of it that tells me part of that creation is things that changed over eons, and that perhaps we don't think of the creation of these creatures as we see them now as necessarily being as God created to begin with. And, you know, we know that there are changes that happen among creatures, that they have evolved in ways, whether you can connect it with evolution, but don't you think some of you agree with me maybe that there's that blending of science and creation?
For me, there's not a blending, but there's absolutely no contradiction in my understanding that we have this growing all the time scientific understanding of creation, that, and we have other creation stories. I don't have any sense that I need to do any mental gymnastics to make those two fit together.
Well, it reminds me that when I was a kid, Tyrannosaurus Rex is a huge lizard, right? Now we know he's a bird. That's the, you know, the ancestor of birds. And so it tells me that our human knowledge is what isn't complete.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our human knowledge is what evolves, and that's why we turn to the Word.
Mm-hmm.
It's because that transcends our human knowledge.
Now, something I always go back to in this very conversation, and despite the fact that he made this statement to try to disprove God, Carl Sagan once was quoted, I can't get the exact quote, but he basically said that God is the God of gaps. And as scientific knowledge progresses, that gap narrows, and we will eventually do away with God. But the truth is, at the more we learn, the more we have to learn. That gap is always infinite. And wherever our scientific knowledge ends, that's where the gap begins. And it doesn't even have to be a barrier. In, you know, everyone, every individual has their scope of knowledge. And at the edge of that scope of knowledge is the wonderment and the seeking that we need to go forward in our lives. And that's where that gap is, and that's where each of our spirituality begins. So that's, despite the fact that it was an atheist statement, I find a lot of my own spirituality in that.
You know, when you said, started off talking about puzzlement, I thought you were going to go a different direction. And so I don't want to attribute what I'm going to say to you in the slightest, but some people I know, a couple of my colleagues at Seattle, use
grappling, and in fact someone who've been dialoguing with on an online website about this, is not about the question of who made creation, but about purpose. And it had to do with animal cruelty, not human to animal cruelty, animal to animal cruelty and violence. You know, that cats pick up mice and throw them around, which isn't just for survival. And, we can all multiply examples of that. Of what is that saying in the face of Genesis 1 and it's all good, or whatever perspective we have on nature is beautiful, when there's this violence and cruelty seemingly built into it that isn't a function of what we would theologically call sin, a choice to go against the order of creation, but it's built into the order of creation.
I think part of what the difficulty comes is that we often aren't comfortable with our own part and role in the whole creation and in our own being. That part of who we've become in our society is so separated from those acts that we don't even see them anymore, but is so separated from our primal brain. I mean, that we, that we send women to the hospital to be anesthetized to give birth, which is a very primal, natural thing, or that we take death and we put it in a little hole somewhere far away, and that we don't let people who are dying die because we're with them the whole time. And both birth and death are often private things. If you're primal, if you're out on the plain in whatever country in the native tribe, you go away to have a baby and you also leave the tribe to die. And we're so disconnected from that primalness that's in us because we've got a lot of comforts and a lot of brain capacity and a lot of, things that can occupy us, that it makes us in so many ways overjoyed at the opportunity to go out and look at birds and look at valleys and, ponder the questions of how this happened and the purpose and the who, because it takes us away from the creation we are in ourselves in so many ways that we often don't get the opportunity to solidly connect with.
Makes me quickly think of Bob Ekblad, a guy who does some theological and biblical work, talks about vortex theology as kind of a liberal appreciation of creation that you can have with expensive rain gear. And that lack of connection with both the violence of life around us and that we are part of, and our own connection to that. That if you're not stripping and beating and weaving cedar bark to keep the rain off, the mist is more easily glorious.
But we see some of that in our society today. I mean, we see bits of that because we see people who want local food, who are growing their own crops in their own neighborhoods on their own land. There's some sense of a desire to get back to that. So I think that we've got, as much as we wrestle with that, there's at least some indication of development in that direction.
I wonder if one of the things that I thought about having glibly from the dish pit suggested images of creation, especially as a way to bring together the variety of folks that are on teaching staff. Then I thought about the prohibition on the creation of images, mm-hmm. and the just that there were have a photographer, and that all of the time when we talk about, you know, that the use of language is also the creation of image, and you know, thou shalt not make unto thyself any graven images, nor the likeness of anything that is in the heaven or in the earth, and the waters under the earth. Maybe it's just a little too much dishwashing.
I'm still sitting with your questions about creation or creationism and science. And as I was listening to your questions, and this might be going off on a tangent from where your questions were, but something that occurred to me that I've never seen in that same light before is, as I listen to these conversations in the society, what I'm realizing I'm starting to be curious about is, and why does that matter to you or to the person who's making the case? Like, what is the case, what is the assertion that person would like to make? Like, well, if God did create in 6 days, what does that mean in terms of the way we live our lives now? Or if evolution is true, like I think I fall in the way you are describing, Laurel, like I hold this creation stories and scientific evolution, and I don't feel it. But as people are wrestling about it, what is the case they'd like to make if one is true or the other is true? It's like, what are people doing with it? So, oh, well, God did create. God is responsible for everything. That means what for me and my life and my community now? Or, no, there is no God. It all evolved. That means what? I don't have answers to this, but I find myself thinking, I really want to start paying attention to when I hear, oh, and this debate has come up in Texas again or wherever. Like, and what's at stake? Like, is it a theocratic worldview? Or, what are the things that people are wanting to do with that? If
I have just curiosity, and haven't you ever wanted to know something in your own mind?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that when you have some knowledge, or at least some realization that you can accept this fact of God's creating all that we have, that I think it prompts one to think more about how we live our lives in relation to creation.
Yeah.
Not all the time. Mm-hmm. We don't seem to be able to do that.
No.
But at least we take some steps that are more in that direction rather than just saying it doesn't matter, you know, we just use things to the extent that feels good.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I followed you. Were you saying that we're able to love more and care for better if we understand creation to be created?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Yes.
I just wasn't sure I was following. Thank you.
I don't know if every individual would have that kind of response, but I think it does affect people in the way they view themselves in this world.
I like your statement. I like what you said. That's kind of, I can see exactly what you're talking about. I mean, when somebody starts arguing that point in Texas, and you know why? You know, what's their ultimate goal or intention? And you know, that's a good point. It's like, it's almost not important, really. I mean, you know, it's not important for me right now for them to, you know, I like that.
Well, we all have our own opinions on that.
Right, yeah.
Well, and I think sometimes it becomes more political.
Oh, sure.
And that's, then things really fall apart.
I wouldn't want to presume to speak for the people in Texas at any level. But I'd suggest from my own work on this question that in contrast to what you two are saying, that it's about just the curiosity of the human mind wanting to understand the world we live in, that much of what's at stake in that question, it has nothing to do with creation. It's about the authority of the Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, if the Bible's not true in a certain way, then it's not true. And since the Bible must be true, it must be true in that way. So it's really not about creation. It's just about that happens to be one of the stories in the Bible that other, as Laurel's saying, and I think most of us feel comfortable with, there are other stories that talk about that, and they seem to be telling something that's at one level contradictory to the Bible. We don't see it as contradictory to the Bible because we don't read the Bible that way. We read the Bible as that Genesis 1 is a poem, not a factual transcript. But if what's at stake is it being a factual transcript, then the evolutionary story contradicts it. And there goes the Bible.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or there goes our sense of control.
Right. Yes.
We want to be able to control the world because, even though we don't care to admit it, it's really out of our control.
Yes.
So having a nice, neat pattern, any kind of pattern, it's helpful or reassuring.
Yes. But it's reassuring in the way that Sue's been trying to get us to get rid of. It's an illusion. Mm-hmm. And part of what Jesus is about is disillusioning us. You know, but if you prefer to live in the illusion,
I think a lot of people do.
Then you hold on to it.
But that goes for any, I'm kind of the same. I can hold all of those in tension with each other, whether it's biblical or whether it's evolution or whatever. And but underneath all of those is this sense of curiosity, and then kind of, if I just know, maybe I can control it a little bit.
I think that that the love and care for and desire to be in solidarity with the rest of creation is pretty, like, travels pretty independently from whether, you know, God made it in 6 days or it's an entirely godless mechanism. That I think that there are those who stand solidly in the special creation camp and understand that it's ours to use up because God made it for us. And those who stand solidly in creation who understand that we have to care for it because it's a gift of God. Mm-hmm. And similarly, that people who understand and embrace the scientific model also both embrace care for and solidarity with and nurture of creation and, you know, mechanistic use it up. There's no spirit in it. And I've certainly had the experience, like, some of my best, you know, God moments have been in academic and scientific discovery and figuring something out. And that also is kind of place and avenue for divine work. So I think I don't think either way those two things go together, however you...
Well, back to something that was said earlier, there's, in both of those stark camps,
mm-hmm.
Never mind all of us here are kind of in between, but in either side, you have both of those Genesis images of, you have one camp that says there is a creator and therefore we must take care of this creation because we owe it to that creator. There's, and on that same camp, there's the creator made this for us to take advantage of. And on the scientific side, there is no creator, this was all evolution, and therefore we are a part of an ecosystem that we must care for. And on that same side, there is no God, there was evolution, and therefore we must go forward and be the cruelty that we see in the environment. So there, you know, on either side you have the exact same philosophies, and in how they manifest themselves in our day-to-day actions. It's just a different language of expressing it.
Well, I said it would start a conversation.
Yes.
It seems to me also we're sometimes handicapped in our thinking about creation when we think about it. Think about creation as simply something that sort of a kind of a one-off event that happened long ago that kick-started things, which is kind of how the biblical narrative like suggested in a way, but and instead of that creation is something, and then creation is an ongoing event. There, every reality is fecund beyond any of our understanding and imagining at every moment. It is gift, all ongoing. In all ways, and so the creation is now, and we're in the midst of it, evolution is happening in the midst of it, in the midst of the moment. To me, that is part of, I think, my the way in which scientific and theological understandings sit together without being in competition with each other is that I don't see an understanding of God as creator as an explanation as such, but a sort of way of, it's almost doxology, it's almost a way of saying, of, it's almost a statement of just kind of praise and wonderment that here we are. And look at what science is learning, wow, and look at the world around us, wow. But yeah, it's not really an explanation to me. That remains a mystery.
This a story that I had hoped to bring and didn't, in part because I have the limited internet access here, couldn't find the references, but when I was in seminary, a teacher who was indigenous man from somewhere in the northern states was speaking to us, who had been a guest somewhere in the Southwest, was hosted by a spiritual leader in that community, and as part of the hosting and hospitality, this person told their community's creation story. And it was around a particular sacred fire in that community, and that in fact the whole beginning of creation and life had begun out of this fire.
Mm.
And that the host took him on another day to a nearby community where the same story was told, with the end that the very creation had happened at this sacred fire in that community, in the next
mm-hmm.
settlement. And so this guy who was our visiting prof asked his host, what do you mean? You told me the same story, and you said the sacred fire was at your place, and now you're saying it's at their place, to which his host answered, well, yeah, today we were in his place. And that honoring of creation and those parallel stories and the whole way that's played out in, you know, Christian imperialism and conversion of indigenous people, that kind of hospitality around hearing and telling one another's stories and understanding where we come from in different kinds of ways seems to be a very live place.
Well, you can sleep on this.
We need the picture of the chipmunk back.
It's been nice to talk with all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
Very nice to hear. And we can't, there's nothing to stop us from talking again. Would you like to do a prayer to go? Gracious God, we thank you for the opportunity that we have to be together in a beautiful place and to open our minds and hear each other and explore this creation, this ongoing dynamic that we're a part of, that we can't probably ever expect to understand. And to thank you for this privilege of being part of this gift of grace. In Jesus' name.